91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Next, we get to know two members of an elite and ever so important profession, paramedics. What's it like to face repeated life and death situations on a daily basis? It's Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Is there any job which creates such stress and pure drama? Those are grim downsides, but there's unmatched reward in saving someone's most cherished loved one. We'll meet paramedic Kevin Grange, who's written a book about his pressure-laden training in a hardscrabble Los Angeles neighborhood. Then there's firefighter and paramedic Tim Durham. He rides with Palm Beach County Fire Rescue. It's a rare breed who survives boot camp training and the everyday stress of saving lives. Topical Currents and all in a day's work after the news. And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, we have a little
audience today.
Extracurricular activity today. It's kind of fun.
We do. We have some very special guests in the studio with us. Well, they were in the studio till we realized, thanks to Richard Ives, that they wouldn't be able to hear
our guest
one of our
on
guests.
Phone.
Yes, Kevin Grange. So, but we do have friends of the station here and a couple survivors left in the studio.
And we had lunch with them.
Yes.
And some really great people.
Yeah, very interesting and very special, and we're very grateful to have them with us. So this hour, we resume our All in a Day's Work series with a segment about those who literally save lives, paramedics. They endure an exhausting, grueling, stressful, exasperating training period, never knowing what awaits them when called.
First, it's paramedic Kevin Graves. He's written a book about his training called Lights and Sirens, The Education of a Paramedic.
It's Kevin Grange.
I'm sorry, Grange. This day is...
Kevin.
Kevin Grange, and his book chronicles his internship with the Los Angeles Fire Department in 2011. He now serves the National Park Service at Yellowstone. You're in Yellowstone, correct, Kevin?
Yes, I am, Joseph and Bonnie, and thank you very much for having me on the program today.
Oh, it's great to have you. Welcome. And in the studio with us is firefighter paramedic Tim Durham. He rides with Palm Beach County Fire Rescue, a 12-year paramedic veteran. Welcome to you, Tim.
Thank you much. It's an honor to participate in your show.
Okay. He's also a longtime listener of WLRN.
So true.
Yes, and maybe Kevin will be too up there in Yellowstone and Yosemite. Okay, Kevin, let's begin with you. You wrote of your book was amazing, by the way. I felt like I could have been a doctor after I read it. You wrote of your very early fascination with emergency medicine when you were a kid, but you waited until you were 36 years old and had your own experience as a patient to pursue becoming a paramedic. Give us a little bit of that history and what made you pursue this at 36 years old.
Correct. Yeah, I was always, you know, fascinated with the fire department. I think most kids can remember playing with fire trucks in their living room or stopping by a fire station to, you know, meet the crew and sit on the engine. I was also a lifeguard in high school and college. But, you know, no one in my family had really pursued emergency medicine. So I think it kind of took me a number of years to find out that's what I wanted to be. Probably the inciting incident came when I passed out after a concert from dehydration and was treated by paramedics. And I just recall that incident. The paramedic who treated me, his job seemed to be a combination of a number of jobs. He had sort of the critical thinking skills of an ER doctor. He had the compassion of a nurse. His leadership skills were that of a great coach. He managed the scene like a competent police officer. And then there was sort of a choreography to the call and momentum that sort of reminded me of like a composer. It really was art in motion. And after that, you know, I just decided, you know, I've always sort of been interested in this field, and I'm going to go ahead and, you know, take an EMT class, which is a 120-hour class needed for someone to, you know, drive an ambulance. And after that, you can do basic interventions, you know, basic airway interventions, you know, stopping the bleeding. And the more I learned about the field and the people I worked with, the more I enjoyed it. And then that led to my going to paramedic school.
Tim Durham, you also got into the profession of paramedics kind of late. Explain that.
I did. Hello there, Kevin. I also joined in my late 30s after some different moments. And it was, a pretty trying experience at that stage in your life to make those decisions.
I just want, for all of our listeners and for myself, really, maybe for all of us, you wrote, Kevin, that going from an EMT, an emergency medical technician, which you just described, to a paramedic is the equivalent of transitioning from high school baseball to playing in the majors. So if you would, could you just break it down for us? Tell us the differences between trainings and responsibilities for an EMT, a paramedic, and how a firefighter comes into this.
Sure. As I mentioned, the EMT class is a 120-hour class. When you jump to be a paramedic, that's at least a 1,200-hour class. And then rather than being part of the scene, you're really running the scene. You're the senior medical authority on that scene. And you can really do a lot of advanced interventions. The scope of practice between EMTs and paramedics kind of differs between each state, but generally, EMTs are not able to break the skin, whereas paramedics can, you know, start IVs, they can give medications, you know, intramuscularly. They can also do advanced airway interventions, such as putting a breathing tube down a patient's windpipe. They can use a cardiac monitor to slow down, speed up, or restart a patient's heart. Along with that, we can also determine death. And so, in a number of areas, the emergency room, you know, they're telling paramedics, unless you get a heartbeat back in the field, we don't want you transporting the patients to the ER. And sort of the message there is that if a paramedic can't get the heart started in the field, then the ER most likely can't. So it's a great responsibility, and it's a great trust. And, you know, all the paramedics I've worked with and trained with, you know, really rise to that occasion and take their job very seriously. So that's kind of a quick little, you know, definition between EMTs and paramedics.
Okay.
Tim, your thoughts?
A great big difference between the different levels of EMT and paramedic. Basically, if you're a medic, you're pushing drugs and really making more determinations of what's going on in someone's physiology and so forth, and what you could do to intervene with that. And as Kevin mentioned, that's all of our medic's goals, is to get that heart going and get them to more definitive care as soon as possible.
Until I read the book, I wasn't aware of the odds of becoming to get to your stations, your respective stations. I think, Kevin, you talked about it, that it was like winning the lottery just to be able to make it.
Definitely. You know, I recently applied for a Los Angeles Fire Department along with 13,000 other people.
Oh.
And, you know, it's a great field, and you're working alongside great people, and it's, you know, highly competitive to get hired with a fire department. And I think, you know, based on that, the public should just know that you have the highest caliber of individuals serving your communities.
Are most paramedics firefighters, and are most firefighters paramedics? Tim?
Tim?
Well, it really depends on the jurisdiction that you're in. My county, my department, basically, we offer full fire and EMS protection for the community. So I would probably say 90-95% of the firefighters are also paramedics. If you're not, basically you've been around enough to be grandfathered in. But it is a requirement for my department when you're hired nowadays that you obtain that paramedic certification within 2 or 3 years of your date of hire.
And Kevin, is it the same out there?
It is. You know, due to the great, you know, fire safety prevention classes that fire departments are doing and, you know, the fire smoke detectors, most fire departments, 80% of their calls are now medical. So a lot of the departments are requiring that, you know, the new firefighters are at least EMTs and, you know, increasingly paramedics to serve on their force.
Tim, before the program, you mentioned to me that you wanted to make it clear that you really love working for the Palm Beach County Fire Rescue, but that you no way purport to be on policies. You're just talking about how you address your job, and that's the intent of our program.
Thank you for bringing that up. Yes, I do love my employer and thinks it's a great department to be with, but yeah, anything I'm saying today is my particular views, not representing the county.
Kevin, you went to this Harvard of paramedic schools, it's called, the UCLA Daniel Freeman Paramedic Program. Why did you choose that one, given, I mean, I know it's supposed to be the best, but it's also supposed to be the most stressful and the most difficult. Why did you choose that?
Number one, you know, based on the program's reputation, and I didn't want a program that was easy. I wanted to kind of go to the best, you know, and then in Los Angeles, I saw a place where during my training, I could run most every type of call, which I kind of equate to similar to a pilot wanting to land in all conditions. I just, you know, wanted to expose myself to as much as I could during school when you sort of have the safety net of instructors and your paramedic preceptors with you. Such that when I graduated, I could just give the best patient care. One interesting note I'll say that, you know, a lot of listeners might not know is one of the first paramedic programs in the country, which actually was the first, came out of the Miami Fire Department along with the University of Miami.
Was that Eugene Nagel?
Yes, it was. Yeah, in 1964, he visited Station 1 to teach the firefighters CPR. He was trying to, you know, improve the survivability of, you know, out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And, you know, once he met the firefighters there, I guess he was so impressed with their competency that he said, you know, why not teach these firefighters additional skills such as starting IVs and pushing medications. And in 1969, the Miami Fire Department was the first fire department in the country to revive a patient using defibrillation. And then the following year, they had the first paramedic program, which was in conjunction, the Miami Fire Department in conjunction with the University of Miami. And at that same time, the Daniel Freeman paramedic program, which the one I attended, also began along with Medic One up in Seattle. So I thought that's a great piece of local history that your listeners would really relate to.
Some items for our next history quiz.
Yeah, too. Right. And good to know something so important came out of here. Kevin Grange currently works as a paramedic with the National Park Service at both Yosemite and Yellowstone National Parks. He's written Lights and Sirens, The Education of a Paramedic. And Tim Durham has spent the last 12 years as a firefighter paramedic and is with the Palm Beach County Fire Rescue. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
And 21 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're visiting with paramedics Kevin Grange and Tim Durham. Tell me, gentlemen, both of you, what goes through your mind when you know you're starting on a call and you almost have to be blank slates to begin with, but you have to assess so quickly and show leadership. Tim, let's start with you, and then we'll go to Kevin.
Well, I'd probably say first is reminding yourself and your crew that it's someone else's emergency and not yours. That, you know, someone else is calling you there for a reason. And, you know, if it's 3 in the morning or if it's the same person that's falling down or whatever, that's, you got to regroup and start with your patient's best interest first and how you can make that situation better.
Kevin?
Tim, hit the nail on the head. The fun part of this job and the challenging part is you never know what you're walking into. And, the dispatchers are wonderful at their job, but they're receiving a non-medical assessment from a caller who's calling in. So even though, we're sort of alerted to the chief complaint, that may or may not be what the actual emergency is. So like Tim said, it's always good to remember it's not your emergency. And, I'm always just confident walking in the door because, my EMS system and all across the country, we're training daily. We're, always knowing the protocols. So we're walking in sort of like a sports team practices every day. We just know the plays. Increasingly, we're kind of doing this like pit crew mentality on calls, similar to like NASCAR where everyone has their role and their job and we've practiced it. So when we get these, critical calls, it just kind of runs like clockwork and, the patients just receive the highest level of care.
Tell us about your very first experience. There you were at school and you were out in the streets in LA and it was a Friday night in 2011 and you had your first trauma case. It was a double stabbing. So what was that like, your very, very first case?
That call actually came in a number of shifts into my internship, although it does start the book. That's kind of the scene the book opens up with. However, my very first day of my field internship with the fire department, the second call I ran was a shooting, which occurred at 10 in the morning. Generally, the shootings often occur in the evening or, during the night. So, we had just gotten back from our first call, which was a diabetic call, and suddenly the tones went off and it was for a shooting. So that, certainly threw me for a loop on my, first shift of internship. And, I was a little rusty, I'd say, but, the adrenaline was flowing, but you just kind of fall back on your training. And the nice thing that we learned in school and, that I'm sure Tim follows is you have a patient assessment algorithm and a way of which you assess your patient, which never changes based on the call. And, I just kind of fell back on that. And, you start by assessing the patient's airway and then you move on to their breathing and then you check, circulation and for uncontrolled bleeding. And, kind of just falling back on my training and that algorithm, I was able to, center myself and, run the call as best I could.
And Tim, do you remember yours?
I believe it was what's called an MCI, mass casualty incident involving multiple cars on the turnpike. And that's a little chaotic with not only multiple cars, but then multiple patients. And as Kevin was saying, your training comes into focus, like he was saying, it's like a sports team, but also your ability to improvise and be confident about improvising in those situations really comes into the personality that comes into your work.
Kevin, well, you interned in the Wilmington area of Los Angeles, rather a hard scrabble area, and many of your calls were gang violence related, and now you're working for the National Park Service, but it must be quite a difference in your calls.
Yes, definitely. In the city, you're seeing calls that are more urban in nature, so your shootings, your stabbings, your overdoses, assaults. So the call volume is definitely higher. But there's also, at least in Los Angeles, pretty much a hospital on every corner. So your transport times are about 5 minutes. In the national parks, the call volume's lower. But, our transport times could be anywhere from 45 minutes to 3 hours. I'm currently working in the Old Faithful District of Yellowstone, and to transport a patient to the hospital, we have to go through three states. So we leave Old Faithful, which is in Wyoming, We exit the park via the west entrance, which is in Montana, and then we take the patient to a hospital in Idaho. The national parks, the calls are also more environmental in nature. So it could be search and rescue operations. Unfortunately, we've had 4 bison gorings at Yellowstone this summer already. It's also nice with the national parks is you have a longer continuity of care with your patient. So you're able to, you know, practice more of your medicine and practice more of your scope. And most importantly, I find it's that extended time you can really make a connection with your patient, which to me is, you know, the greatest treatment, just making that personal connection, you know, their anxiety level goes down and, you know, just hearing their stories and, you know, doing the best you can for them.
And I was wondering, you know, Tim is here with his wife and daughter, and I started thinking about the stress of this job and how that might impact family life, at least. So I know you have a family, Tim. How does that get to you? Does it get to the family?
Yes, to all. You know, there's a physical aspect and I think a mental aspect. And, you know, you could be coming home and in pain. I don't know of a firefighter that really doesn't have back issues. But also you're sleep deprived, and sometimes I could be a little edgy, on edge.
How long are your shifts?
24 hours. And then I have 48 hours off. So, yeah, it depends on, you know, I could be a little moody. But, you know, the best part of my day is coming home and seeing that family, and that makes it worth it.
And also, how do you respond emotionally from every day or almost every day seeing something that most of us would find just very hard to see and to comprehend it?
And that's tough. That's one of the things you need to weigh out when you come into this field, is there will be images that will haunt you for your lifetime, but there's also rewards that can build on that too. So, yeah, which one are you going to dwell on?
Kevin, you also wrote about when you were in paramedic school that some of these big, tough guys had to leave because they just couldn't handle the blood and volume and vomit and gore and stuff.
Correct. In my program, you know, the program has 3 parts. It starts in the classroom for 4 months and then moves into the clinical space where you're in the ERs and the labor and delivery rooms, practicing your skills on, you know, live patients, and then it goes into the field internship where you're running the 911 calls. And during my class, I think we lost about, you know, 10 to 12 people. And in the classroom, anything less than 80% is a failure, which is definitely a different grading system than the college I went to. So, you know, our final exam was about 300 questions. We had 1 opportunity to pass. And if you didn't get an 80 or higher, you were terminated from the program. So we lost a number during the classroom. And then, you know, we lost a number during the field internship. And until you're out there running calls on the street, you know, you never really know how you're going to react. Sometimes the best students in the classroom weren't able to translate that book knowledge into the field. You know, possibly they're overthinking calls. So you never really know, and everyone reacts to it differently. But like Tim said, you know, I sort of focus on family and, you know, friendships, you know, after a tough call, and, you know, eating healthy, staying healthy. And, you know, to me, that kind of just keeps you on track.
Tim, I wanted to ask this. We did a show recently on medical directives, mm-hmm. on, you know, people and where they should put their medical directives for the EMT if they have a heart attack or some kind of a medical event. And
especially if they live alone.
And right. And exactly. And there was kind of a disagreement. Some said they're supposed to put it in an envelope on the refrigerator, and some people said in a plastic bag in the refrigerator, in the freezer. Where are, at least in Florida, I don't know if it's the same in every county, where when you go to a house and there's nobody there but one person, you know, and they've called 911, do you look for medical directives?
I do, and I not that I'm aware of, there isn't a blanket answer for, you know, put everything here. Yes, I'm going to look on the fridge. I'm going to look in the bathroom to see if there's a medication list. I ask people if they don't have that. It's like, hey, next time can we have a little bit of your history? You don't need to put your social on that, but... You know,
so we should, I mean, for those of us who live alone, should we all have something that we put somewhere that an EMT can, or a paramedic rather,
just
can
thinking
find?
Selfishly, yes, that would help my job out. There's some other programs that go on that folks could put a certain color envelope in their glove box, in their vehicle. So if there's something like that, that we could have direct information saying, okay, this person has cardiac issues, or, you know, at least clue us in of like, this is a diabetic, he might have gotten to this wreck because of a sugar issue or something. So it just helps jumpstart our triage.
We're speaking we're in our All in a Day's Work with paramedics today with Kevin Grange, who's currently a paramedic with the National Park Service, and Tim Durham with the Palm Beach County Fire Rescue. We'll take a short break and we'll come back and ask you to join in the conversation. And welcome back to our All in a Day's Work series. We're talking to two paramedics today, one at Yellowstone National Park at Old Faithful.
Must be nice to be there at this time of year.
Yeah, must be. Kevin Grange. Yeah. He's actually not only a paramedic, he's an award-winning travel writer with the Society of American Travel Writers, and author of Beneath Blossom Rain, 24-Day Trek Through the Himalayan Kingdom of Bhutan, which gives us an idea of why Kevin works outside. And Tim Durham is with the Palm Beach County Fire Rescue. If you'd like to join in the conversation, questions for a day in the life of a paramedic, which we haven't gotten really to at length, or if you're thinking of becoming a paramedic, or if your life has ever been saved or impacted by a paramedic, you can call us.
1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. You can also email radio@WLRN.org.
I need to ask you this, Tim, because I'm a South Florida driver, and I see...
I'm sorry to hear that.
I know. But does it seem like when people are confronted with fire rescue or with an ambulance or something, that South Florida... Have you ever been an EMT anywhere else? I mean, a paramedic anywhere other than Palm Beach County?
No, I have not.
Is it my imagination, or do fewer and fewer people pull over when a fire or rescue or ambulance is coming through?
That is frustrating, because a lot of people will just freeze and stop.
They're paralyzed.
Yeah.
I know it could be bewildering when you see lights and...
Right.
Or you can't get over.
And sometimes you can't get over.
And like most of our intersections that...
At rush hour.
Tough.
Right.
And as you're in your ambulance or your fire truck, you're like, make a hole. And there's no really right answer. Yes, I'd like to say everybody pull off to the right. But sometimes that's not always safe.
So,
you know,
what,
if you have a four-lane road.
Right. I guess Kevin, you don't have that problem too much there in Yellowstone National.
Well, he's been in L.A. So.
Yeah,
we have traffic jams in Yellowstone, but it's mainly due to a herd of bison competing for the roadway with us.
What is this with the bison stabbings? Is this because of the things in the climate or the environment that the bison have a place to?
Rutting season, right?
Pretty much, it's more, you know, everyone wants that perfect selfie with the animal.
Oh, my God.
So they're all of the bison encounters are due, you know, we recommend people stay at least 25 to 100 yards from any, you know, from all wildlife. But, you know, the iPhones, they don't do great distance shots. So all of the encounters have been, you know, people walking pretty much right up to the bison, or you'll get a group and they kind of, unknowingly form a circle around the bison, and then he's got no exit. and just kind of acts out from that. So luckily, none of the injuries were life-threatening. People weren't hurt seriously. But we're just trying to make sure everyone knows, especially this summer, that you need to stay 25 to 100 yards away from the bison.
Here's something I have a casual interest in. When I go to my local grocery store, I sometimes see the emergency medical people shopping there. What about chow, since you're on 24 hours a day? Do you cook your own? Do you have someone who's designated as the cook? And is it as good as it's supposed to be?
How did I know this topic was going to come up? Yes, most of the grocery stores you go to, you will see some sort of fire rescue vehicle there. No, the public does not buy our food. We all chip in usually in the morning. Some stations like to do breakfast, lunch, and dinner. My particular station will just, like, anybody have ideas for dinner? And we'll pitch in $7 or something like that. And we try to take turns cooking.
I'm wondering about occupational hazards, like getting injured on the job by somebody, you know, by a needle or by... you know, just a contagion, whatever it may be, contracting diseases that you're treating people with. And if a two-part question, that's part of it. And the other part is about, I'll ask that part first.
the occupational part. Again, as Kevin and I were saying, that your training comes into this. So we're not just doing protocols on what kind of dosages of drugs to give, but it's also how to protect yourself. Because if you're not protecting yourself, then you can't protect your patient. So the first part is we have continuous training of how to don and doff certain types of equipment. You have your crew saying, hey, you're exposed. Everybody wears gloves. You need to have a mask on, eye protection, things like that. So majority of the time, we're pretty good at keeping each other at bay with that, and just being awareness is the biggest thing.
And Kevin, if you would explain this BSI and scene safe, and is that the first thing you do with any situation?
It is. So on every call, BSI stands for body substance isolation. So as Tim was mentioning, depending on what the call is, dictates how much protection you wear. If it's a simple medical, you might just wear, exam gloves and safety glasses. So that's the BSI part. And then you always want to make sure the scene is safe. On a shooting, for instance, paramedics might be first in the area, but unless law enforcement has secured that scene, we're not going to rush in there because, again, the scene might not be safe. So that's sort of the motto that we practice by, and in paramedic school it kind of became a joke, because if you don't verbalize BSI, scene safe, during
you
your
fail.
Practice scenarios. Yeah, exactly. So I was wondering, hey, should I say that during the field internship with the fire department? And one of my classmates is like, if you say that with the fire department, they will fail you, just because it's just kind of a joke that you would be kind of like Ricky Rescue, verbalizing that. Of course, they would want you to take that on scene. But,
right.
Verbalizing it would kind of make you look like a rookie. So,
you bring up that situation of in a shooting, if the police aren't there, you don't go in until the scene is safe and that law enforcement is there. But you spoke in your book of a situation where the paramedics were sued or something because they didn't go into a situation before the police came. And so I'm wondering about liability issues. Is that a big thing for paramedics? Kevin?
There's always the threat of liability. If you follow your protocols and you do a good patient assessment, the liability is very low. As far as that particular lawsuit, they swayed on the side of the fire department just because, again, they did the right thing. And if you have your first responders injured, they can't provide care to the injured person. So there was that lawsuit, but, again, it didn't amount to anything because, that's sort of the protocol that we follow.
Some of these rescues that you described, Kevin, were in family outing scenarios, or also I'm sure you wind up with the domestic arguments or maybe violence going on. How do you handle people who might be drunk and it's a domestic and family problems, and somebody is very ill or injured?
Yeah, those are certainly the tough calls, because, you know, in school you learn a lot of the techniques to start an IV or to, you know, run a cardiac arrest. But as far as just knowing how to talk to people in these stressful and, you know, emergent situations, that's a whole nother skill. And I think coming to the profession late in life, I'm sure Tim would agree, we have sort of that life experience such that, you know, we're able to talk to more people just because we've, you know, worked most of our life and encountered a lot of people. But there's no book on how to tell someone that you couldn't save their, you know, their loved one in a cardiac arrest. But I just find, you know, you kind of let them know you did the best you could. You explain the attempts you made to save their life, and you know, you just kind of mourn with them at that time.
We're speaking, it's all in a day's work, we're speaking with two paramedics, Kevin Grange and Tim Durham, about their profession. And we're going to take our last break, and we'll be right back, and we'll take your calls.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with paramedics Kevin Grange and Tim Durham. If you'd like to join in the conversation, we have a couple of lines open, 1-800-743-9576, and also email radio@wlrn.org.
Kevin, you write that paramedics are one of the most recognized but least understood of all healthcare professionals. What do you mean by that?
I think with our lights and sirens, we're seen and we're heard, you know, as we respond to calls. But not everyone knows how we treat patients, the treatments we provide, and just what a difference paramedics can make. That was part of the reason why I was inspired to write my book, Lights and Sirens. You know, there's this idea of the golden hour, which is that first hour in which interventions can make the most difference in saving someone's life. A lot of people think that starts when they get to the ER, but it actually starts a lot earlier when the paramedics respond to the scene. So the ability of a paramedic to identify a critical patient, provide that initial life-saving treatment, choose the correct hospital, which may not be the closest. For instance, if it's a cardiac complaint, it might make sense to bypass the closest hospital to get to a hospital that has a cath lab and, you know, cardiac physicians there 24/7. And then just how to transport the patient there. Should they go by ground? Should they go by helicopter? So that's really the difference that paramedics can make, so much so that the profession actually originated because there was a study in 1966 that found that if someone suffered a major traumatic injury, they were more likely to die on an American street than in the zone of combat. And that was because until then, there was no organized system of identifying critical patients, treating them, and transporting them to definitive care.
It's unbelievable that this just started in 1970, really, when you think about it, because we just take it as part of our lives and depend on it.
Sure.
So, and it doesn't, it's, I was very surprised when I thought, oh, they've always been here. And then I thought, well, I guess they haven't.
How about ongoing training as you work your career, Tim?
That's a huge part. And that's what keeps a lot of your focus there at work. And we happen to have a state-of-the-art facility that we could do all sorts of physical training as far pertaining more to firefighting, and also classroom environments where we could do medical scenarios and so forth. But it's ongoing, whether every day at shift you're doing training with your crew, you know, hands-on, or if you're on a computer doing, you know, watching videos of here's something new and new protocols and things. So it's in every shift you're doing some sort of training.
Kevin, do you ever have people you've saved contact you after?
I do, and certainly we don't do our jobs to be thanked afterwards. We do them to help people, but it's always the greatest feeling when, you know, someone stops by the station. I had a woman this winter who hit her head, and, you know, I recognized that she had a brain bleed, so I called out the helicopter, and she came back, you know, 2 months later and brought a gift basket, and, you know, we all actually ended up in tears, I think, just because, you know, these emergencies are traumatic. You know, you're moved when you run an emergency and there's a connection with the patient. And, you know, just seeing her courageous recovery from that and, you know, coming back to thank us, it was a great experience. And, you know, we're still in touch and a friendship has developed, you know, between myself and that family, which is, you know, the greatest feeling.
You know, it's funny you're talking about the connections and the personal relationships. And I'm thinking about how generally we think that doctors try and keep an emotional distance. But it sounds like from what you're saying, and maybe you agree, Tim, that you actually develop these personal relationships with your patients as opposed to trying to keep the emotional distance, would you say?
I myself, earlier in my career, I would pursue, I think, more folks and seeing how they were doing after the fact. Past few years, I've needed some sort of disconnect a little bit, just
to make it
and that's just worked for me. That's not in all cases. There's some ones that I am still involved with, but I've needed some of that disconnect just for my own sanity and well-being at home.
And you, Kevin?
Well, I think both Tim and myself, when you're actually running the call, I find emotion, you know, can get in the way. So you want to just be very clinical but yet warm. You know, there's steps you need to do to save their life, and you're just going to do them. Once the patient's stabilized in the ambulance, you know, then I find kind of making that connection, you know, can lower their anxiety, which in turn, you know, decreases the workload on their heart. But yeah, you need to find that balance between treating a patient, but also kind of letting the calls go. So it's a good balance. And I guess I find, you know, whenever I sort of let the patients dictate the relationship after the call. If they stop by the station and, you know, they want to add me on Facebook, then I'm certainly happy and excited to stay in touch with them. So, yeah, just, you know, we are, you know, we serve a community, and, you know, I think it's good when there's that give and take there.
What about your anxieties? How do you fight burnout, both of you?
Yeah.
Tim, you want to go ahead with that one? Then I'll follow up.
Anxieties, an everyday thing. With when I come home, there are certain activities that you like to do, but a lot of times you just decompress and spend time with my daughter and my family. Sports is a great outlet and so forth, but anxiety is something that really needs to be addressed more. And it seems like nowadays people now have a name for different types of anxiety, whether it be PTSD or some sort of other psychological factors in there, and whatever you name it, it needs to be addressed, because it's at least with the colleagues that I know, there isn't one of them that doesn't have some sort of
stress. It would seem like
stress.
PTSD would be something.
Yeah, I think it's a huge factor
that you would,
and I don't like to label things like that, but maybe it is labeled. I'm not sure.
Do paramedics have a short what do I want to say,
lifespan?
Well, yes. I was going to say lifespan, but I don't mean their lifespan. I mean the time that they're paramedics.
Career.
Yes.
I wouldn't say so. There's some that will be interested in doing 20 and out, and I've known some other ones that great colleagues that have worked 30 plus years, and everybody deals with it a little differently. 2 years ago, a colleague that had 8 years, he just had enough and said, I'm going to move on.
Is there an age limit after which you can't be a paramedic?
I think Kevin and I think pushed that. We got hired.
No, but I mean, is there an age that you have to retire?
Oh, I think it depends on each municipality or so.
Well, Kevin, do you have annual physical tests, I suppose?
We do, yeah. And, both on the firefighting side and the paramedic side, you need to be in top health just so you can, provide the best patient care. If you're going to the second story, the second floor, and you got to wait 5 minutes to get your breath back, that's 5 minutes you could have spent helping somebody. So all of the people I know in the fire service and in EMS, they're constantly staying healthy, both because it helps relieve their stress, but primarily so they can just provide better care to the communities.
And any animals? Have you ever had to, have you ever been in danger from an animal, or have you ever had to save an animal?
At Yellowstone, we get a call for a lot of, it comes in as like a hot dog. So a lot of people visit Old Faithful and leave their dogs in the car. So, as a park ranger and paramedic, we're just there to serve the visitor in any way we can. And some days that's, responding to a call, and if the dog's in danger, we'll, access the car. And I haven't, apart from taking the dog out, I haven't done any, I haven't provided oxygen or anything. But we get those calls pretty much daily at Old Faithful.
Oh.
And as far, we do have occasionally cars hitting animals, bison and elk and whatnot. But until this summer, the human-wildlife accidents have been pretty minimal. I think this summer is just kind of it's unique in that way. But hopefully you won't see many more.
What about when people are faced with some sort of situation and they ponder, well, is this serious enough to call emergency rescue or not? And they kind of waver over it. Should they just err to the side of safety and say, let's call?
Are you saying when the public calls or... My determination.
No,
if it's an emergency.
The public, the patient's resolve.
I get that often enough.
I know Tim talked about somebody called with a nosebleed once.
That's not uncommon. Some folks don't have a ride to go to their doctor, so they'll call 911. I have another
person.
That's
rare, though, isn't it?
Not as rare as you think.
Okay.
Someone else, their son works for, he's a deputy, and so she calls 911 and asks for her son. Now, she might need some other sort of assistance, but, I do err on the side of caution, saying, again, it goes back to your emergency, not mine, and maybe there's an outlying thing of what's going on. Maybe they're experiencing some sort of anxiety.
Right.
Well, we certainly want to thank you both.
We do. Kevin Grange works as a paramedic with National Park Service at Yosemite and Yellowstone National Parks, and he's an award-winning writer with the Society of American Travel Writers. The name of this book is Lights and Sirens, The Education of a Paramedic. Thank you very much, Kevin Grange, for being with us, and best to you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I've had a wonderful time today.
And Tim Durham has spent the last 12 years as a firefighter and paramedic now he's currently with the Palm Beach County Fire Rescue. Thank you both so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
And thanks for tuning in. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our All in a Day's Work series was created by Peter Mertz. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction provided by online producer Paul Leary. And if you'd like to hear more or listen again, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org.
And we want to thank all our guests today for being with us, for having lunch with us, and it's been a pleasure to have you all. Thanks so much.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned now for Here and Now, next from NPR News.